I had a shift in my self-worth. Transitioning to mom, for some, I think can be a big transition. And I went from having immediate feedback all the time from my clients and, you know, my career, to suddenly questioning, you know, how am I contributing? What am I worth? And it was a little bit of a shock to my system. I hadn't realized, it became very apparent to me, how much I had wrapped my self-worth into my income and into that contribution.
Welcome to the Healthy Love and Money podcast. If you find money to be the number one, two, or even third largest source of stress in your relationship, then you're in the right place. Going beyond how to budget, invest, and do your taxes, we're going to explore financial intimacy. Discover how to talk with your partner about your shared financial life. Let's take the awkward and painful out of money conversations. Join me and hit follow to listen to weekly inspiring, healing, and motivating interviews with financial therapists, couples therapists, and financial planners, and so many more. Let's go on the journey of financial intimacy together. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the second part of this incredible interview with Sarah Carr. For those of you that are maybe just catching up or retuning in, Sarah's been on this incredible journey of growth and transformation from her religious background and money background to one that's evolved and changed quite a lot. And I think we're going to get to kind of the climax of the story, if you will, in the second part. So stick with us as Sarah continues to share her journey of growth and transformation and healing. Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Sarah, you've been on this incredible journey. At this point in the story, you were betrothed to be married. That didn't work out. Because he felt he got a message from God.
Said that I wasn't worthy, right? I would have ruined his ministry. So I came away from that feeling very unworthy and like I had failed. Failed God.
Failed God, really, which profound, right? At that point, that loss. And I imagine it's still profound for you, but there's been healing around that even for you.
Yes.
That's because personal worthiness is a big part of what we talk about in money work, right?
Right. Yes. Yes. And we're getting to that point in the story because what I had done was really had gone from that unworthiness to this place of finding success in my career. And that became really where I built that worthiness, right? I was had just hustled, I would say, you know, for that worthiness aspect. And I was getting that feedback, right? I had that external feedback of you are smart, you are successful, right? I had the financial confirmation that I was growing in my net worth, if you will, and I was making a decent income. I mean, there were times that there wasn't, but you know, over time it kept building. Like, and as I found my way in my career, I found that success and found that financial safety, and that's really what it felt like.
Yeah,
till that point.
To that point. So, and then
I married again. So a second marriage, and this time, and I was in a good place in my career. So I was making really decent money. I was at this point, I was actually in my dream job. It was the ultimate type of job where I was doing financial planning. I was mentoring other advisors. I was salary based and I was getting a nice salary. There were bonuses, right? I really didn't have anything to worry about.
Okay.
So financially I was in a really good place, loving my job. I get married. And my, second husband, he had been divorced. So financially there were a few stressors, you know, as you rebuild from any type of divorce. And then also I would say he had three older children. So we were in the midst of college and cell phone plans and insurances and cars. So it was like a very expensive time of life. I don't know if there's other higher expensive lifetime with, you know, young adults that you're trying to get through life.
Wait, so just, you know, as listeners, people will notice, depending on where they're at in their life stage, because I'm even having this, I mean, as I'm listening, I'm like, wait, but I'm not at that stage. I thought the baby phase was the really expensive phase and the daycare. And you're saying, no, it's its own expensive type, but there's a whole new set of financial transitions that a family's working through as their teenagers are coming of age and their financial expectations and needs are greater. And they're far more vocal about it. And they have... Right. Very strong opinions.
Yeah. And it depends, I would say, on everyone's family situation when it comes to college. Like, what are you providing for? Are you providing for living expenses? Are you providing for some of those college, some type of college loan payments? What does that look like? So we were covering a good chunk for some of, as the children aged. And then also you add in the fact that he was divorced. And I think it's okay to name this. I think we've all talked about it in the family, that there is that guilt factor. So there is the aspect of like, oh, you know, Christmases, vacations, you know, things like that tend to be a little bit extra in order to offset the guilt of a disrupted family.
No, I think that's so important to name. And I think, you know, I'm spending a lot of time kind of revisiting and talking to other professionals that really specialize in blended families. And that's something they talk a lot about, is how do we navigate our feelings about not being together in the original family and now having this blended family, and how do we make up for that? And
yeah.
And so the spending is a way that many families navigate that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'd say going into that relationship, we had some good, healthy communication. Nothing was really hidden. We were pretty open about that. We kept, for 2 years, we kept most of our expenses fairly separate. He had managed his household, and then I kind of covered the fun stuff and our living expenses as we were maintaining. We were really maintaining two separate mortgages, two separate housing situations. But it was workable. And okay. And then we decided to have a child of our own, which was already pre-discussed before any of that, like before we ever got married. It was well planned. Yeah.
Part of the vision of the relationship.
Was this child, yes. Yeah. And then the time came. Our original plan, though, had always been that I would continue working. And that was something that had been important to me. But the opportunity presented itself where the house that he owned was a family home. He had grown up there, and part of his divorce agreement was that his ex-wife could live there for as long as she needed to. And then eventually she would move out. Well, that time came where she ended up remarrying. She moved out of the house. So now we had an empty house. And so it seemed to make sense. And the idea was proposed, why don't we sell my house and then we'll move into this family homestead? And that happened, like, I think I was maybe 8 months, seven, 8 months pregnant.
Oh boy. At the time. Oh boy.
Right. Oh boy. So like the decision factor, like, was like, okay, yeah, like, let's make this happen. Let's explore this plan. And then, you know, it was, well, if we move, it's further away from my office. And while I worked from home, like one day a week, I was still going to the office regularly. So it was, let's actually give you the opportunity to start your own practice. You've always wanted to. Now's the time to do it. We don't have a whole other mortgage, you know, expense, and we can reduce household expenses. We should, on paper, right? Being the financial planner that I am, do everything on paper. On paper, this all looks good. Let's do it.
Right.
So, like, I have this baby, and I move into this house, and we do a bunch of remodeling and all that good stuff. And then I start my own practice. Like, really, it was just at that point in time, I really wanted to focus on being a mom and having time with my son. I'd let go of any asset management at that point in time. I was like, I'll just do fee-only financial planning. I actually consulted for the firm that I left, which was a nice kind of segue for everybody involved. And it was great until it wasn't so great, because all of a sudden, I had a shift in my self-worth. Being transitioning to mom for some, I think, can be a big transition. And I went from having immediate feedback all the time from my clients and, you know, my career, to suddenly questioning, you know, how am I contributing? What am I worth? And it was a little bit of a shock to my system. I hadn't realized, it became very apparent to me, how much I had wrapped my self-worth into my income and into that contribution. I don't, you know, I can only speak to my experience. My experience is that it was very difficult for me. The plus side of that was I had extra time on my hands and had been doing you know, I'm always, I had been in coaching relationships before career coaching. I had always participated in different things. I had started doing some work around shame with Brené Brown's workshops and things like that.
I had
picked up the book, The Wisdom of Ebenezer Scrooge. I don't even know how I ended up with it. Read that, was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I want to do. Ended up talking to Brad Klontz personally, like a phone conversation. Yeah. He's like, you got to get involved with the Financial Therapy Association, check them out. Like, you know, at that time I started exploring, what are these money scripts? You know, what does this look like? And exploring, oh wow, my worth really is attached to that. I don't want that to be the case. Where is this coming from? So I had done, a lot of work around those money scripts and what it means to be a contributor. You know, what are these other aspects of my life as a mom? What value do I bring? So it was a journey that started out there.
So I think what I'm hearing is you went through this big life transition, kind of multiple pieces all at once.
Yeah.
You're now married, you're having a baby together, you're moving into his family home. And you're changing work. And this is where it starts to really expose, like, how much you had started to associate your personal worth with your income and net worth and that trajectory. And now that was all kind of collapsed down, that, you know, I didn't have my home as an asset anymore. It was our asset as our shared home together. I don't have my income has changed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there was probably an aspect too, which I wasn't able to name at the time, but I felt like I had lost an aspect of safety, right? I was entirely reliant, you know, on my husband at that point in time, my housing situation, right? Also, I will also name that, remember, I had left in that first marriage, lost a lot of my community. Right. I had lost the church community that I belonged to, some of my extended family. So when I married, his family and his friends really became my family and my friends and community.
Right. That makes sense. Like, that was part of maybe what made him so attractive was, hey, this guy has a family and a community and I can kind of just plug in here.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some other things we could talk about at some point in time, like as far as I know what I was trying to reclaim by marrying him. There is definitely this aspect of kind of this power couple of being able to, we were both in finance really wanting to have a partnership. And yeah.
Can you speak to that, the power couple and part of the attraction of that? Because that's something that I have seen. I have kind of identified, now my wife, if she listens to this, she might be really upset. Sorry, honey. But like, I had that power, I didn't have the word power couple in my head, but I kind of had this idea that who we would become together, the two of us would be great. And she had this rising career as a dentist, and I was going to be this very successful financial planner in my mind. And the young, immature view of what it meant to be a financial planner, let's just say it was more about making a lot of money than it was about helping clients.
Totally understand that. Yeah.
So power couple is a whole psychological phenomenon, I think, for quite a number of couples. And what have you come to appreciate about the nature of power couples and from your own experience? And
that's a good question. I think for me, my experience was let me back up a little bit. What I had always seen too in the church, if I can name that too, was an example of a power couple, right? Where you have two people that are really coming together in this space of becoming pastors or doing God's work. And, you know, they're really powerful people. People admire them, appreciate them, right? And they're doing good work together. And I think for me that when that relationship with that pastor had failed and I was told that I was no longer worthy, right? Like, there is this aspect of, okay, now I want to reclaim this and I can do this in a space that feels comfortable to me. Cause even though I had walked away from the church, now it was business and it was in this business world. of like business and community, right? Like
we can
show up in the community, we can do this good business, we can be really great people helping our community and being involved. And he had a lot of respect in the community. At least at the time, I feel like he had a lot of respect in the community. Sorry, Jeff, if you're listening. He was involved in like Little League, and we served on boards together when we both worked at the same financial institution at one point in time. We both served on boards. There was a lot of that aspect. And I think I had aspired to being like his partner in this space that was empowered.
Okay.
And that seemed attractive to me. And
then that makes a lot of sense.
Became a stay-at-home mom. and that changed. And at the same time, my definition of success really changed, right? Because I'm evolving that sense of worth. My definition of success is evolving. I'm no longer, personally, in my personal journey, no longer looking at those external factors of, yes, I still wanted to be respected, but I want to be respected for the person that I am, not necessarily everything that I do. And, you know, and I started to recognize that financial success isn't everything, right? I had met with clients that their financial success wasn't necessarily making them happier. I had done enough research on, you know, what it means to live a meaningful life and its purpose. And it's less about the financial net worth, it's much more about meaning and how do we create a meaningful life. So I began to transition towards like, what am I about as a person? Where does the meaningfulness come into play? So it's less about the accolades, the success, the promotions, the, you know, that worth. So it was both uncoupling and healing from that and redefining what I consider to be meaningful in life.
Sure. Yeah.
As my son aged, and we did have a daughter after that too, so there was a few years of me being really in the thick of it. But there were times of talk about, well, would you go back to work? And, you know, you could make hundreds of thousands of dollars here. You know what I mean? Like you can make three figures, you know, what am I trying to say? You could make a lot more than what you're making. So instead of making $20,000, let's be real, instead of making $20,000 a year doing your thing, and this made basically being a tax write-off, you could be making a considerable amount of income. And wrestling with that, like, yes, I can, but that's not meaningful to me. I'm not working with clients the way that I want to be working with clients. I don't want to just go in and sell product. I want to be able to have conversations with them about what's meaningful to their life. I want to make a difference. I want to pursue kind of these tools in the financial therapy world. And there is a whole aspect of that.
So let's just name that for listeners. You know, I think there's going to be a number of people that are professionals that are listening to this, but there's going to be a number of everyday folks. Please don't take that as an insult. Just non-finance money professionals that don't know the inside industry realities. And this is part of the challenge I think that both you and I, Sarah, are trying to solve for is much of the financial services industry, the compensation is based on assets gathered or products sold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the compensation is aligned with that. And so there's not a lot of incentive just to have multiple meetings with time for reflection and integration and processing different patterns of thoughts or feelings, which is all kind of part and parcel to the world of therapy, where we spend lots of time just kind of in that space. And so I'm not throwing stones fully at the product and service side of it, because we need that too. We need our investments. Mm-hmm. We need our insurance products. But we also need time as humans to just tell our story and to be heard and to make sense out of things. And so,
Yeah. And I'm not saying, let me also be clear, I am not saying that financial therapists or those in the therapy world don't make money or can't be financially successful. But I don't want to come across
complain those either. Things either. Yes.
No. But there's a big difference from creating a career, building a career from kind of scratch versus going into an established company and working underneath them. Right. Those are two different things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you're working through all of these things and then what happens?
And then I think because I was doing all the work, you do some surface work, and then what happens? You get to the core. And what happened for me was all of that trauma from my past resurfaced. And it resurfaced in a way that I was able to look at it for the first time ever and recognize that what happened to me was predatory. That was the first time. So we're talking decades. So when they talk about abuse survivors not realizing that they were abused until decades later, that was very much my real experience. I had not framed it that way. And after doing the work of around shame and around self-worth, I recognized, that relationship with that pastor, he was 26, I was 14. That makes no sense to anyone, right? Like, and it speaking it out to myself didn't make sense. I was like, wait, there's something wrong here. That was not a normal experience. And then recognizing that all of the abuse and the sexual abuse that happened in that was not my fault. That was not me being lax on my boundaries or not policing myself or, you know, falling under, the trap of the enemy, if you will, or something like that. That it was not me.
It was none of the religious explanations that you had been told or trained in.
Right.
There was actually a whole fundamentally different lens to see what you had been through. This is big.
Yeah. It was big. It was very big.
It continues to be big, and we can honor space for it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Healthy Love and Money podcast. I want to take a moment to invite you into a deeper conversation about you, your loved ones, and money. Seeing couples talk more openly with each other around money is so amazing to me. Eye contact, a gentle touch of hands, a relaxing in the shoulders, even a lifting of weight off the chest. It doesn't start that way in therapy-informed financial planning. Couples just like you feel hurt, misunderstood, and experience resentment about some part of their financial life. There are many reasons why. It can be differences in spending patterns, concerns about emotional connection, shutdowns and blow-ups about changing homes, vacations, kids' education, and so much more. Maybe there's even that unaddressed tax issue or a struggling business that you just don't know what to do with. Therapy-informed financial planning draws on the best practices from both the fields of therapy and financial planning to help couples go from feeling stuck and frustrated to safe and free. Check the show notes below to schedule your free 30-minute consultation to learn how therapy-informed financial planning can help you. I look forward to talking with you soon, Ed. Now back to the show.
So it was a process of recognizing that, letting that resurface. Naming it, coming forward. I came forward to my family. I came forward to church members. And then I ultimately came forward to law enforcement because I was under the aspect of I don't want someone else getting hurt, or if someone else was hurt, I want my story to corroborate their story. And when you do that, for me, I was experiencing that trauma for the first time, right? So in that space, I had a lot on my plate emotionally to deal with. And in the midst of that, within my marriage, suffered a very deep personal betrayal. And so I was at a place where I was like, oh, I have nowhere else to go but to do the work. Like, I've got to do I jumped right in. And thank goodness I had resources. And go ahead. Do you want to ask a question?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I have to do the work. I'm imagining kind of what you've been alluding to and talking about as we've been building in this story is you've been starting to read personal development books. You read some of Brené Brown's shame reduction work and a number of other things probably similar in that kind of area. And kind of in my mind, what I was imagining is like you're building up this resource pool for much deeper work that you didn't even yet know was coming.
Yeah.
But then when it finally just kind of breaks wide open, it's like oh, yeah. That's what all these books were talking about, really. And now yeah. I need to really dig in. And because I have yeah. nowhere else to turn, I don't have my faith to turn back to. I don't have my spouse to turn back to.
Right.
Family is fractured-ish at this point.
I would say it was a little bit fractured. I had support of some of my family. It was just hard. Like, I think anytime abuse comes to surface for parents, it's really difficult because they felt that they were trying to do their best to, and I fully 100% believe that my parents thought that they were. There's a whole other aspect of their own walk that they've had to do in that responsibility. They've taken responsibility, but it was a lot for them. So, right, for them to be supportive of me was really difficult to be there, because then they're also experiencing their own trauma, if you will.
They're really having to come to terms with, like, who I thought I was, what I thought I was doing as a parent, and then what actually happened for my child. There's this huge gap, and it really kind of breaks them open psychologically, if they're willing to entertain it. Sometimes parents are.
We were. Yeah. Okay. I will say both parents were willing to do that. So I will say I had friends and resources. I had therapists that were friends and lots of connections. So I ended up getting involved with, I had a marriage therapist, a really amazing marriage therapist. I had a trauma specialist, that was specialized in EMDR and IFS, and so internal family systems. I also had a therapist that was trained in religious trauma. And because even though I had that therapist that understood the trauma aspect of it, so much of my trauma occurred within the church system. Right. And that's a whole other aspect to kind of unravel. And I ended up, I'll be honest, in that relationship, I was doing a little bit of training of explaining, this is why this was so hard for me. You know, this is why I felt shame around this, you know, because this is what the church believed and this is what it taught. Whereas when I was working with someone that already understood that, they were able to hold some reflection for me.
And they could hold reflection for you. They could be empathic with you. They could even ask kind of questions that you hadn't yet fully considered for yourself. And this is, I think, something for listeners to also really pick up and take away, is this is making kind of a parallel argument for why financial therapy is so important. Is because unless you really reflect on the nature of people's experiences with money and the diversity of ways that people experience pain around money, things like, there's just a lot that can be lost in the subtle details. And yet for psychological healing to happen, it's often being met in the subtle details of the experience and being held. That really is where the healing happens. I'm not coming up with a great analogy, but you can't just go to, like, hey, let's help you set up a budget or let's create a financial plan and that will help you feel more financially secure, when you watched your father drink and spend the family money down on the business, and the business failed, and your mom was irate all the time, and all these things. So, all that to say, like, understanding a person's religious system and what that meant, and being able to hold kind of a, I don't know, Sarah, if it's the right word, outsider position. Like, maybe you've lived through that, but you kind of stepped outside of the system, and you can look back on it reflectively. It's really the only way. But because you go back to people in that religious community and say, hey, this is how you guys hurt me. This is the problem that you created. But they still fully believe in the system. Right. They kind of look at you like you're the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had lots of that experience, you know, because I was somewhat connected to some of those church members still. Part of them are in my family. So having those conversations, it was very much like, well, you failed. I mean, I've still had aunts and uncles that have said that to me, like, you failed here, your parents failed you, you know, never naming the predator as the predator, you know.
The predator is the predator, and the system that created and developed and fostered the predator, because this is my belief system, and maybe it doesn't match yours, is he probably wasn't born into this world as a predator.
No, of course not. I totally
He was groomed into that position through his own collective constellation, not justifying or making okay what was done.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then protected in it, right? Never, there was no accountability.
Yeah. So, all right. So you're really into the heavy, deep work now.
Yeah. We're talking like, I mean, hours upon hours of therapy. And I will say, I recognize, and I want to be very, aware that I was privileged in that. Like I was not working a full-time job. We had financial resources right within our household that I could afford to spend the money on therapy and all of the extras.
Do you think in some ways it took actually getting to that place? Part of it was getting to that place of level of affluence and not having all the other demands on your life that you could actually break down and do the work.
That's a great question.
Because it's like, I think you know, that
because I wasn't in survival mode anymore.
You weren't in survival mode anymore, and so then your brain kind of recognized, like, okay, now's the time I can deal with this. There's enough money to go into this because you had built awareness about what therapy was about, and you had some cognitive awareness of what this is all about.
Yeah,
made sense. But I have thought about that for myself and for other clients that. It's almost like when you reach a certain level of security, then you have this major kind of, I don't want to say relapse, but it like
kind of feels that way.
But almost it's finally a time to let down and let your guard down. Because it's like, I'm not hustling to make income. I'm not hustling for all these other things.
Yeah. I think that there is absolutely something to that because that would have absolutely been my experience. I mean, I do think there was the aspect too, right, of that circular, like the surface work, having done that to be in a place where I could do that. And I think our parts of ourselves know.
Yeah, that's why I want to be careful. And for listeners, please hear, this is not single cause. It's all these factors. Because let's keep in mind, Sarah had given up her house that she bought. She was a mother. You know, was not making the income she was used to. So those were all parts too that kind of brought this all back around for you to really dive into.
Yeah.
And so Sarah, can I ask, how long has it been since kind of that like really opening up and working through?
6 years. That was 6 years ago that I really jumped into all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm smiling. Listeners may not be able to see that. but there's something that seems magical is a word that does not feel right, but it's the word that's coming is getting into that 5, 6, 7 year place is where you really start to feel like you're getting more on the other side of it. Some of the adverse impacts are not fully resolved, but there's enough of resolution that it's like, I can go out into the world and share my message. And so part of why, I guess why I'm really wanting to highlight this is for anyone that's listening that either hasn't gone on the journey yet or is in the depths of it, you don't have a responsibility to share your story with anybody else. No. Part of the reason why Sarah is able to share this story is because she's been in her own journey and worked for a long period of time now.
For me, really, it did take a long time to get comfortable. Like, so while law enforcement knew, certain family members knew, therapists knew, certain close friends and support people knew, but other than that, no one was really aware of my story. And it took me a long time to get to that place of still doing some of that work, right? Of being in this place where I feel safe, being in this place where I am worthy, and countering still, even after doing such significant amount of trauma work and doing a significant amount of reframing everything, and growing, there are still aspects. Like it's one of those things where you still have a moment, like you're smiling. I can see listeners. You can't see. I can see Ed totally was like, yes. He's resonating with this.
Yes. Well, you know, and listeners, what you don't know is Sarah and I were having a talk just before this and I was hopping on and kind of talking about my day and she's like, and so where's the joy in your life, Ed? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm in my like kind of workaholic compulsive, like everything has to be hard mindset. And you know, it's like, we don't even recognize that we've slipped into our old mindset sometimes. Like we can't see ourselves clearly. It's not like we get a little red light on the dashboard that says, ah, the fuel's low, time to go to the gas station. It's like, But that's why like the mm-hmm. self-awareness piece is so important, is becoming aware, like, and questioning, well, what state of mind am I in? Where is that coming from? Is this true now?
Right.
Right. Yes. And being able to unblend, like, because it was true that there were parts of life that were very hard, very challenging, very threatening for you, Sarah, for me, probably for most of the people listening. Like, we're not dismissing that there has been some real shit ass experiences that have been terrifying. Mm-hmm. And today, where you sit, you may actually be perfectly safe and secure. And you may be having a really hard time in your mind reconciling that I sit here in this place today and I'm actually fully safe and secure and provided for. Yeah. While I was not at this other point in time, because our brain will conflate things very easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's those like memories, right? Of emotion doesn't have a timeline.
Yes. And I'll say that one more time. Say it again.
Emotion doesn't have a timeline.
Nope. There's no time.
It does not know. It does not know past, present, future.
Nope. That comes from our prefrontal cortex, not the limbic region of our brain, as I have come to understand it. Right. Oh, and let's just add, our nervous system also does not tell time.
No, it does not.
I'm super nerding. Sorry, listeners. Sarah's with me though. I think this is why childhood trauma is so challenging, is because our sense of time is not developed as children. It's just forming. And so we can't differentiate past, present, and future very well as children. Anyhow, that's for a different podcast episode. I'll catch my breath. Let's go back. Focus. So Sarah, so you're 6 to 7 years now, really past like the deepest part of like, oh, this was trauma. This was not anything else but deep trauma and violation.
And this is what I want to say. That work was insanely difficult. Insanely difficult. And there are times where I wanted to give up and just be like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. You will have those moments. Push through to the other side, because I'm on the other side of it now. And even though I still have moments that I feel deeply and can be difficult to navigate, and I don't have that disassociation aspect as much anymore. Still so worth it. And those moments of joy and embodiment and connection and experiencing the world like I've never, ever experienced life before. Mm. That is worth it. It's worth that work. It's worth the time, the energy, the money, everything to get to that place where you feel like I have this intrinsic sense of self-worth that I feel is absolutely unshakable. It's something that nobody could ever take away from me. And it's been reclaimed, and now I get to come to life in other ways and reclaim other parts of my life and sit in this place where I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be in this world and be in this life, and it's so much more beautiful and meaningful.
Just sit with this for a moment, listeners, and notice your own reaction to this, because some of you will be in a place where it's like, I'm having a hard time even recognizing what that might mean. Some of you are like, I'm on the journey trying to figure this out, and man, I'm not really sure that I'll ever get there. And some of you may be sitting in that place of like, yeah, I've claimed my own intrinsic worth and I feel a lot more joy. And know wherever you're at in the journey, you're welcome here, you're welcome with us, and this is really what it's about. And kind of bringing it full circle, like, how has this changed the way that you experience and think about money, having claimed this intrinsic self-worth?
Yeah, I think it's been critical to my sense of, my financial well-being is much more of a holistic experience. Instead of me feeling like I have to always work hard to earn income, I recognize that I'm a capable human being, and regardless of the circumstances that I'm in, I will find a way to bring forth my talents, and I'm a resource person, and I can show up and do whatever work I need to. It's a different sense of I can create wealth, and by wealth I mean not just financial wealth, right? But the things that are creating a beautiful life. So, moments with my children, moments with people that matter to me. And it's a different sense of being. And it definitely spills over into how I show up in places.
So can I just make this real practical? When you log in and you look at your bank account, what happens for you now?
Okay. So most of the time it's really amazing. I will say, like, recently I had a situation with my car I'm going to have to replace, and it's a big purchase. I don't have a car payment right now. And my first reaction was like, I'm not ready. I planned for another 6 months, you know, to have this car, and I might not make it 6 months. So, okay, I've got to do this. And then I went into this panic mode of like, oh, like, right. And I felt the shame. I sat in that for a couple of hours, and then I came back to like, okay, wait, like, I have options, right? I think when we come to a place of self-worth, it's easier to expand that view instead of it coming down into what I did or didn't do right. Because that's what happens to me. It becomes very much like, I should have, or I didn't do this right. Or and you get into this shame spiral of, I'm not worthy, I'm not worth, you know, like, I failed, like, all of those languaging. And instead I sat back and said, okay, I have options. What are my options? Okay, I have money in my bank account. I can put a higher down payment down. I have available credit. I can go, I have a good credit score. Like, I have put myself in these healthy positions. I have lots of options available. I can go get another part-time job. But like, if I really needed to do that, could I make that too? Right. Yes, I have lots of available resources. So I took myself out of that panic and this mode of, I'm a bad person because I didn't plan appropriately for my car, you know, whatever that shame messaging is.
Right. Oh, yes.
And for that, no, like, I can do this differently. You know, let's look at the options. So it expands, I think, our sense, and it puts us in a place of empowerment, right? I have choice. My circumstances aren't dictating to me, and I'm not in a place where I feel powerless or.
So can we just play this out so people can hear, like, what I want people to hear is, like, Sarah did go into a state of shame when she looked at the bank account and realized, shit, I don't have enough money for the car in the way that I thought and I had planned. And then it's kind of self-beating up, self-loathing for a few hours. And then something shifted for you and you got reflective and you said, wait a second, hold on. There's more than one way to do this. Here's some different options. But let's just imagine that you hadn't done this work and you were the Sarah of old.
Mm.
How would this have played out? And it's all speculation because you are you now.
Yeah.
But you know how you were back in the day. So how would this have, because I think a lot of people can relate to something like this where they log in, they see the number and they have this immediate reaction like, I'm not enough. I screwed up. I effed up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bad. And then they go into reaction mode.
Yeah.
And it's just,
so for me, it would have been so like I would have collapsed internally, you know what I mean? Thought it on myself. And then I think I probably would have stayed in a state of just disassociated from it. Like, and just, and probably ignored it until I couldn't ignore it. Yeah. And it's funny because you asked that question and honestly, there was part of me that wanted to say, well, for one, if I had been the old person, I never would have divorced.
Well, that's true, right? Okay.
The factor. I, you know, the old me never would have felt strong enough to venture and, because I am divorced now. Maybe our listeners probably missed that piece.
Right. Small detail, but I am divorced. Yes, I am divorced again. You heard that correct. That's two. Yes, if you're counting.
Small part of that as that healing journey continued. And yes, you're divorced for about 3 years now. So the old me would have not done that. I had to get to a place where I was like, wait, I am worth something and I am capable and, you know, I can survive, right? More than survive. Like, it's really like, I can thrive. I'm okay. I am safe and I am okay.
No, I appreciate you naming that and sharing that. And I think, you know, where I went in my head, and this is why I'm glad I asked, is because this is more about my money story, is I would have gone into the work harder, hustle harder, you know, like, and just grind it out and come down from the office grumpy.
Yeah.
You know, and the kids and the wife are like, what the hell is going on with that guy? Not knowing that I just looked at the bank balance and was all triggered up because now the balance is not what I thought it should be. And now I've got this financial responsibility. And well, now I'm just a shit provider.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I would say that there is probably part of me that was like that for a moment because I do have that aspect of child responsibility. Thankfully, my kids weren't around for a couple of days when this was happening.
Yeah. Right.
And honestly, I was working. And there was an aspect of like, oh, like, where can I earn more money? Because I really need to live it. Yeah. That was part of it. Yeah. But also I will say it wasn't just that, like it was that for a moment. Right. But then it became that expansive. Well, okay. Yes. Yes. Right. So then it became this is the approach I'm taking. It's only one way. It became, I'm going to do this and this. Right. It was not either or, it was this and. So it became the solution is much broader.
And to me, you know, I'm hearing, I feel like it's the voice of Dan Siegel. Do you know Dan Siegel's work? Interpersonal.
Yeah.
So Dan Siegel, I'm a fanboy. I'm going to own it. You know, the guy's brilliant.
I love it.
But, you know, and I'm not quoting him correctly. I'm paraphrasing at best, but the essence of what I think he's trying to communicate is like, how do you know when someone's dealt with their trauma is exactly what Sarah has shared in the last 10 minutes or so. Is it's not the stopping of being triggered that's going to so much say that you're done with trauma. It's how you respond to when you're triggered and whether you can get back to this open, expansive state of mind and be in a both and flexible state. Neither rigidity or chaos is a lot of what Dan talks about is if I'm in rigidity or chaos, that's a sign that I'm really highly triggered. And a healthy state of mind that's integrated allows for flexibility and options. And you can take action on those options without being paralyzed. If you're paralyzed by your options, you're still in the trauma state of mind because there's still something that has you wigged out or fearful. So Sarah, this has been such a powerful interview and, you know, look, we could probably do a 10-hour series and, you know, really give the listeners a go around on everything in your life and my reflections and whatever else. But for today, we'll bring it to a close. And as we think about the whole arc of this story, what is it something that you would like listeners to really be able to take away?
I think that it's never too late. Life has never passed by enough. Wherever you are on a journey, I think everything, every step has opportunity to bring you to where you are today. And don't be afraid to do the work and to sit with some uncomfortableness in order to get to a place where you can be in a place of expansiveness and be in a place where you can be empowered again. And that's a journey. It looks different for everyone, but there are resources now sure. more than there ever have been.
And, the accessibility of resources. So what's a favorite resource that you like to lean on or draw people's attention to? It can be a book, a blog, a podcast, a social media person. You could say, God. Oh, Ed, I love your stuff. No, I'm just kidding. So shameless.
I like a financial therapist. That's an excellent question. You're really putting me on the spot because I feel like I have so many resources. You're like asking me to pick one. I'm like, can you narrow this down?
For you're me? Like all my children. They're all my favorites. Okay. You don't have to do one, two or three, four, whatever. You know, what are some?
So for religious trauma, I highly recommend Religious Trauma Institute or Reclamation Collective for resources for that. I highly recommend Brené Brown's work, very accessible for any kind of beginner work on shame resilience. And shame is rampant in, you know, everything related to money, I feel like. And then I have to plug away for the Financial Therapy Association. There are so many amazing, talented financial therapists and counselors and, resources there that are just huge. So highly recommend going to the Financial Therapy Association website. We have our directory, plugged into amazing resources. Yeah. Now I'm curious to know, when you answer that question, what do you say?
Oh man. Well, as I look over at my desk right now and I see like four books. So one that I've been reading recently is called The Quest for Legitimacy. And it's by Jamie Weiner. How children of prominent families discover their unique place in the world.
And so,
you know, for people that grow up in affluent families, highly affluent families, or parents that have high status, so religious pastors, he's actually the child of a rabbi. And so I think that there's a lot there in the psychology of growing up in prominence and the impact. And so really continue to enjoy that. I have another book called Brothers, Sisters, and Strangers, dealing with sibling estrangement. And then we were talking about this earlier, but Gail Coleman has her wonderful book, The Body of Money. Yeah. So many layers of depth there. I've only scratched the surface on that. But
oh my God, yes. I know, right? And I feel like that's a huge aspect because there are so many resources that are head knowledge, but right. Such an important part of trauma therapy. And I didn't mention this, is the somatic aspect. I mean, yes. I did a lot, like as much therapy as I was doing, I had actually did somatic yoga. And trauma therapy for like yoga for trauma therapy. And it was hugely impactful. So I think any resource that gets you in your body is huge too.
Yes. Yes. I could not agree more. So Sarah, you are also an incredible resource. If people want to hook up with you or connect with the work that you're doing, how do they find you? Where should they connect with you?
They can find me at sarahcarfinancial.com on socials. It's at Sarah Car FP. That's what it is. At Sarah Car FP for financial planner. Yeah. So Instagram, Facebook, all that stuff.
All the fun social places. And we'll get this in the show notes, all those links. So don't worry. You'll find Sarah. Sarah, I'm so glad our paths have crossed. And I know it's only the beginning of many great conversations to come.
Always. Always a pleasure, Ed. I'm so grateful for our friendship as well.
I invite you now to stop for 5 or 10 minutes and reflect on what you just heard. Maybe even journal about it. Give yourself the time to consider what you just heard and what it means to you. By giving yourself the time to reflect and integrate what you just heard, it will help you along your journey of learning, healing, and growing towards financial intimacy in your life. Please like and follow this podcast and share it with someone that would benefit from being on the journey of financial intimacy. Wishing you healthy love and money, Ed.